Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
And I know the answer to the question that everyone keeps asking. I know why you did this. You did this simply because you were not in a cage.
But was she dead on the day I arrived?
She was dead when you killed her.
I agree with the family. I hope you die in prison as well.
It disgusts me that you are allowed to exist.
There is absolutely no good reporting on today's case. It is either told with no empathy whatsoever and a bunch of oohs and ahs, or told by AI, which gets all its facts messed up. Actually, that's not completely true. There was one curious reporter named Peter Talbot that did some digging into some background information for the News Tribune. I think it was an effort to solve a puzzle of what led to the events of today's case. I'm not sure he was necessarily successful in answering the why questions very clearly, but he did the work of tracking down some people that actually knew the victims that are involved in today's case to find out a little bit more about them, which is more than I can say for most of the reporting that was done on today's story. So thank you to Peter. You are a true gem. So I have relied on his in-depth coverage for some of the information when it comes to background and from people who actually knew and interacted with the players within here. This is the murder of the Vosslers. Miles southeast of Tacoma in Pierce County, Washington, sits a town of about 43,000 people. It is a town that was once famous for the Meeker's Hop Farm and originally home to the Puyallup First Nation people, which translated means the generous people. A modern Puyallup was home to the Vosler family, who lived on the 18900 block of Eastwood Avenue East in the Hillsboro at Silver Creek development between South Hill and Graham. William and Eileen Vosler were the kind of couple that kept to themselves, but they were always very kind when they were spoken to. They had lived in their Puyallup home for decades. They had raised their three sons in a neighborhood that felt very safe to them. It was predictable and very quietly suburban. Their lawn was always well maintained. The porch light came on at night, turned off in the morning. The community had come to know Eileen and William and their adult son Shane, who lived with them, as common fixtures in the area. William spent a lot of time outside polishing and maintaining his brand new Silverado truck that he had purchased, and it sounds like it was kind of a first-time new truck purchase for him. The nothing-to-see-here kind of family, ordinary from the outside, stable, although maybe a little bit reclusive. On October 18th, 2018, Shane changed his Facebook relationship status to in a relationship with a woman named Sue Bin Lee, who was an artistic and quiet young woman who had moved in with the family in around 2021. Shane's Facebook is filled with a lot of gaming memes and kind of gaming stuff that I never really understand, but it was clearly an interest of his. In his About section, it says that he is Vice President of Lead Game Designer at LC Games, which is probably maybe not actually true, not a real company, but more one of those female breast inspector type of things that maybe in this case only gamers would understand. It also says that he attended the International Academy of Design and Technology in Seattle, which is a real thing. He studied gaming development there. Sue Ben's Facebook page is very different than Shane's. Hers is filled with posts about jewelry and jewelry design and some artwork that she had done. Her About section puts her as self-employed and attending the California College of the Arts, where she was studying animation. At the time that she set up her About section, she was living in Taunton, Massachusetts. She was originally from South Korea, and the pair had met playing video games online. It was a team-based game called Overwatch. The couple were quiet and both socially awkward, but their small community of friends that they had online adored the two of them. And one of their longtime friends, Paris, told the News Tribune, quote, "They all loved him, you know, and Sue and him were kind of the king and queen of that group," end quote. Now, Paris had known Shane for about 10 years before then she actually then met Sue. Paris had been the one that had actually introduced Shane to that game Overwatch, where he played and then met Sue. But Facebook is kind of a dying endeavor for anyone younger than 35 these days. And so the last time that Shane posted anything on it was April 8th of 2024. It was just a meme about the weather in Washington. The post before that was from April 1st. It was just a picture of his dad's new truck that he had purchased. And before that, when he was a little bit more active on Facebook, there were a lot of posts about gaming and pictures of Halloween type stuff. And Sue and his pumpkin carving efforts, which were actually quite impressive. He received a number of birthday well wishes on November 10th of 2024. He liked those posts, but he didn't comment on them. And the summer of 2024 kind of came and went. Neighbors took very little notice of the house, with its blinds were closed all the time, and the mailbox was slowly starting to fill up. It was summer after all, and families do go away on road trips, and they visit cabins that maybe their family has had for years. So it wasn't really particularly noteworthy. And then fall came and the leaves started to change. Halloween came and went, and then Thanksgiving. And then still the house remained silent and still, like there was no activity at all. No one knocked on the front door or questioned the family's absence. And that November, Sue Lee had posted some poems on her Facebook page. They were a little bit cryptic and sad. She talked about feeling trapped and of wanting to disappear. But her words were kind of just brushed off as that poetic sadness, the kind of post that a lot of times people will just kind of scroll past without really digging in and thinking about it. By Christmas, the silence had stretched a little too long, and the family was finally noticed that they hadn't been around. So a welfare check was requested on December 23rd when a neighbor of theirs had noticed that William's new truck was being repossessed. And it was something that they found really odd, especially with the silence that had sort of engulfed the house over the last few months, and the fact that before that he had been quite active out there, you know, cleaning it and taking care of it. So officers came out, but nothing seemed really amiss. So they were legally required to leave. And then another call came in on the 29th of December. There were no signs of any forced entry and still no reason to really enter the property. And it was the same thing then on the 30th, which was the following day. And then finally on New Year's Eve day, so the 31st, Shane's friend Paris contacted Shane's brothers, who agreed to travel to Washington to gain access to the house to see what was going on. They both had like keys for emergencies, but they didn't live particularly close by. The Valsler's other sons had not actually heard from their parents since the early summer, and although there was distance between their contact that often lasted months, something kind of felt a little bit off about their lack of communication this time. So they used one of the keys that they had to enter the house, and they immediately backed back out and called the police when one of them found lying in one of the bedrooms a decomposing body of what was probably a woman. So when the police arrived at the house with cadaver dogs in tow, it revealed a rather psychological unraveling that is kind of impossible to comprehend. The air was thick with the smell of decomposition, and in a bedroom on the upper level, the body of Sue Bin Lee was found, and it was noted in the reports as, quote, obviously deceased, end quote. And then in the master bedroom, they saw that bathroom door to the ensuite was locked, and there was some like what looked like dried blood peeking out the door from the floor on the tiles under the door. There was a single bullet hole through the door itself. Now they tried kind of forcing their way in through the door, but there was something blocking it. So they kind of looked through the bullet hole and under the door as well, and it was Shane. He was laying on the floor dead from a single bullet through his head, and that single bullet had also then pierced the door. Now, as police worked to clear the scene, they made their way into the garage where there was this deep freeze, and on the freezer was taped two handwritten notes, one of them reading, "Time of death, July 24th, 5:45 a.m., and then the other, "Time of death, July 24th, 3 p.m. But that didn't really make a lot of sense to them. Like, how would Shane have written a note noting his own time of death? And there was no way that Shane's body had been there since July. I mean, it was in a state of decomposition, but more likely closer to like a week or so, not several months. So they opened the freezer, and inside were the bodies of William and Eileen. They were crammed together in an awkward embrace of sorts. Now, what was so unusual about this crime scene was the varying times of death. So it was determined by autopsy that William Valsler, who was 68 at the time, had died from a stab wound to the chest, but coupled with blunt force trauma to the head. And it was estimated that Shane's cryptic note had likely been correct about his time of death, that it had happened back in July. Eileen Valsler, who was 66, had multiple stab wounds to her head and neck area. The July time of death tracked for her as well. But based on the state of the house, food had somewhat recently been eaten and laundry had been done at some point since the summer. So Shane Vossler's death was ruled a suicide, and the manner of death for Sue Bin Lee remains a little bit of a mystery. She had either participated in the killings of William and Eileen, and the pair had made this sort of suicide pact, which was carried out months later, or she had been another victim of Shane's warped mind. Based on the pattern of the bullet wound to her head, her manner of death was not actually able to be determined if she had shot herself or if Shane had done it. But it was clear that William and Eileen had been murdered, and they suspect that it was Shane that had done that. Now, according to the press release from the Pierce County Sheriff's Office, Carly Capetto said, quote, "Everybody in that household died at a different time frame, with the son being the last one to be deceased. The mother and father had been deceased since sometime around the summer. The son and girlfriend continued to live in that home for nearly 6 months or more when those deceased parents had been in the home with them," end quote. So they conjectured that the reason their deaths had gone undetected and unreported for so long was that they were not very involved in the community. They really kept to themselves, and that Shane and Sue had coordinated what they called a collaborated suicide. But they did confirm that Sue had been dead for longer than Shane, likely by several days. And it was later found, based on some online activity, that Shane had been playing online video games as late as December 23rd. Carly concluded her press release saying, "We're going to be closing this case because we don't have anyone to charge." The medical examiner's report is a key piece of evidence and matched up to what we were leaning towards, end quote. And so that was kind of it for the story. There was no motive uncovered, nothing really looked into, and nothing left to really investigate. But Shane and Sue had lived among William and Eileen's corpses for months, like day after day. Putting them in the freezer preserved their bodies. So did they plan on living there, hoping that they were never going to be discovered? Was suicide always part of the plan? Had there been a plan?
The Pierce County Medical Examiner says 68-year-old William Vossler and 66-year-old Eileen Vossler were found with multiple stab wounds. Their deaths were ruled homicides. The medical examiner says 33-year-old Shane Vossler, their son, died by suicide. The fourth person, 34-year-old Sue Bin Lee, died of a gunshot wound to the head, but the manner of her death has been undetermined.
Out of all things, one of the elements that helped authorities crack this case open was one of the victim's love of his trucks. That's because they say he was always in this driveway working on that truck. Then, though, he wasn't seen for many months. And then comes the news and really the shock of seeing a repo agent towing that truck away. As soon as that happened, neighbors say they knew something was terribly wrong.
It's eerie. You don't know your neighbors. You don't know what they're going through. You don't know what's happening.
The shock just does not end for folks in this neighborhood.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
More than a week after four people were discovered dead in this home, deputies now strongly believe it was a murder-suicide.
That people were experiencing that and whatever transpired before, you know, it's just heartbreaking, honestly. It's just so quiet. You know, kids playing and, you know, no one's yelling. There's no fighting.
According to the search warrant, months passed before Shane eventually took his own life inside this home as well, all as his parents were still in that freezer. Also dead inside, Shane's 34-year-old girlfriend who'd been shot. An investigation is now underway to find out her manner of death.
There was police tape. There were a ton of cars, a ton of activity. News were here.
Neighbors tell Como they saw Shane handing out candy to trick-or-treaters on Halloween, meaning he lived alongside his dead parents for at least 3 months.
Now, I'm a person that wants answers, and closing cases like this is not good for me and my overthinking brain. It tends to keep me up at night. Fortunately, Peter Talbot, who's the reporter for News Tribune, has a mind much like mine, and he is an actual real-life journalist that can dig and research into files that I have no access to. And he was able to actually track down some friends and family members to try to gain some insight and perspective on what might have happened in the Vossler's home over the summer to Christmas seasons of 2024. Obviously, there is no definitive conclusion as to what happened, but based on what Peter was able to sort of research, the motive likely came down to frictions between Shane and his parents, and possibly with Sue as well. We will likely never know if Sue knew about the murders of William and Eileen, or if she was simply a bystander to that, or if she was a willing participant or completely unaware of what Shane had done. But Eileen Vossler may have some unresolved trauma from her past that affected her journey through life and through her parenthood. Now, before she had married William, she had been married to a man named Kenneth Gehring. And the couple were living on a farm in Graham, Washington. In 1989, she left him due to some disturbing behavior on his part that led to him being under a restraining order, which he frequently ignored. Eileen had reached out to her neighbors, Tom and Ruthita LaCrosse, and according to an article that I found in the Los Angeles Times, on June 6th of 1989, Eileen was visiting with the LaCrosses when Kenneth showed up there. He took her car and drove away in it. So the sheriff's deputy was called out, and he then gave her a ride home. Now, the next morning, on the LaCrosse's farm, there was a guy named Kirby Hall. He was a truck driver that was standing outside of the milking barn when Kenneth showed up again, this time again looking for Eileen. Kirby and Kenneth exchanged some words, and then Kenneth shot him with a rifle. And hearing this commotion, Tom ran out with another of his farmhands, and Kenneth pointed his .22 caliber rifle at Tom and then forced him into the farmhouse where Ruthita was. So she was in the kitchen. He shot them both and then turned the gun on himself. Now, Kenneth did not have a criminal record up to that point. He was, what they think, just distraught at the breakup of his marriage. It could have been the trauma from this incident that led Eileen to being a little bit of a recluse in her life and not very involved in her community, having very few friends or people that she was close with and interacted with on a regular basis. But I can only speculate on that. But what I am pretty sure of is that this incident would have had a profound impact on Eileen that would have followed her for years afterwards. By 1999, William and Eileen were married with their third baby on the way. William had been in the Coast Guard since 1974, and then he retired in 1999 due to an injury on his back that ruptured a couple of discs, which he was scheduled to have surgery for. And due to not being able to work and then draining their financial resources on medical bills, the couple then declared bankruptcy in February of that year. They were still living in Graham at the time, which was a small town. It was only about 3,500 people in it, and it was where Eileen's previous family tragedy had taken place. He then later got a degree in business management. Little else is really known about Eileen and William other than that they were devout Christians, particularly Eileen. And according to a Starbucks barista that Peter managed to track down that worked at the South Hill Mall, a guy named Peter Fix, in 2010, when Shane was attending school, would be college, Eileen would drive him each morning to school in Tukwila, and then they would stop in each morning. Eileen always got herself a mocha and Shane a frappuccino. And according to Paul, Shane always dressed like a man in his 50s on vacation, and the two of them seemed socially awkward and a little bit sheltered. And sometimes Eileen would ask Paul if he believed that Jesus was his Lord and Savior. And Paul would just kind of awkwardly answer like, yeah, totally. It was Shane's friend Paris Rizzi, though, that seems to have the most insight into Shane and Sue's minds and possible motivations. Although, again, nothing conclusive. Most of Shane's interactions with his friends was over the social media site Discord. And Paris's opinion is that Shane and Sue together murdered his parents, and that she was concerned that, of course, mental health was going to be blamed for it, and that she felt that that was wrong. And she told Peter, "I know he in cold, cold blood murdered his parents. I cannot begin to explain to you the horrible, horribleness of what they've done and sort of how badly they've just destroyed the rest of Shane's family," end quote. But another friend, Josh Capps, he sees it a little bit differently. He says that Shane was a man of morals and values, and he just could not believe that he had done that, like if he had been in his right mind. Quote, "It breaks my heart because now he's not going to be remembered as the friend I knew him as. He's always going to be remembered as the person who did all that stuff, and that's what hurts," end quote. It is difficult to know the family's actual financial situation in 2024, but it appears by online conversations with Shane that the family had been doing rather well, at least according to Shane's accounts, who didn't really seem to have any concept of money and sort of a entitled view of the world. Paris said, quote, he thought everybody had a chauffeur on speed dial, end quote. Now, it could be that that was just a facade that Shane had to sort of make himself appear to be in a little better financial position than he actually was. Or it was true that William and Eileen were wealthy. They did appear from the outside to be doing okay. I would not say that they lived a lavish lifestyle, but if they rarely went out and did things, then they could have a pretty good stash of cash savings. Regardless, he didn't talk a lot to Paris about his family life, other than that she learned that his parents were very conservative and religious, and Shane was maybe not so much. He saw God as a little bit of a joke. But he definitely appeared, at least, to respect his parents and their beliefs quite a bit, and he was obedient to them without any argument. According to Josh, before Shane met Sue online, he was lonely, and he spent most of his time alone in the house, not going out and living his life almost exclusively online while his parents were out at work. And it was Josh's impression that this living situation he had was designed by his mother Eileen more than, say, an introverted nature on Shane's part. It's hard to say if that was true or not. I mean, I wouldn't blame Eileen for being concerned about her children being out and about and trusting people after everything that she had been through herself. But Shane's other brothers had moved out. They were living away and living their own lives. So there was something maybe about Shane that was different kind of all along. Meeting Sue changed things for Shane, and he talked about Sue a lot to Josh. The three of them kind of became friends on Discord, and they would play these games and chat for hours at a time. And Josh told Peter, quote, I think they were just two lonely souls that, you know, found something and they just wanted to hold on to it. I was just happy for him, end quote. Sue moved in with the family sometime in late 2021 or early 2022, and it was kind of a decision that had been made exclusively by Shane and Sue, and he wouldn't really address how his parents felt about her arrival and her staying there with them under their roof, their conservative roof. I mean, it was two unmarried people sharing a bedroom. It probably didn't go over all that well. And then Sue was kind of the opposite of conservative as far as religious and political values. She was very liberal and adamantly anti-Trump, especially in regards to transgender rights and immigration. She often referred to William and Eileen's views as kind of stupid. So this difference in opinion likely did cause some tensions in the household, but she did continue to live there. Sometime in 2023, Shane started to have some dizzy spells and getting really easily out of breath. So in May, he had a bunch of tests done, but they were all kind of inconclusive. They weren't able to come to any kind of diagnosis. So Shane did some online research and kind of self-diagnosed himself as having POTS, or Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, which causes you to have this high heart rate, some dizziness and lightheadedness, especially when you're transitioning from sitting to standing. So he was scheduled to see a specialist in October. I have no idea if he actually went to that appointment or not. Now, according to Shane, his condition got so bad that he actually had a wheelchair to get around the house in. But according to him, his parents didn't believe that he was actually very sick, and they were basically saying, just get over it. And so he had to hide the chair from them when they were home. And again, there is really no way to verify if any of this was in fact true. Looking back, Paris kind of wonders if he was in fact faking it for some sympathy. By early 2024, Shane's online presence was starting to fade away a little bit. His username would appear less and less frequently on Discord, and when he was there, he wasn't really in the best of moods. And Paris muses that what might have been happening, and I just want to be clear that this is just Paris's opinion, it is not facts necessarily, was that Sue was kind of picking fights with Shane's parents, particularly his mom, she thinks, and that Sue believed very strongly in Shane's illness and she wanted his parents to believe him and be supportive of him and helpful instead of dismissive about it. Quote, what it would do is get his mom worked up and then his dad would have to step in and Sue would go back up to their bedroom while Shane dealt with the fallout, end quote. Now, Josh also noticed some changes in Shane around June of 2024 when he stopped responding to his messages and when he would reply, which was much later, he would give these just really short, often one-word replies. By August, he had completely stopped responding at all. Now, in that August, after, of course, it turns out that Shane's parents were dead, Paris had asked him like how his game development thing was going, and he said that it was on pause. And she said that she knew then that something was wrong because he wasn't the type to just sort of give up his passions and things that he was somewhat obsessive about. He was a little bit obsessive about his gaming. And so she says that at that time she was frightened. But I will add, not really frightened enough to reach out to anyone at that point. So I think we put that down to being hindsight being 2020. I'm not blaming or judging in any way. It's just that I think that things get passed over. Alarm bells don't often go off until we reflect a little bit. But when Shane didn't respond to her Merry Christmas message, her concern really started to sort of ramp up at that point. Now, the first welfare check had been made by neighbors. And that was on the 23rd, which is oddly the day that they believe that Shane actually took his life based on his online activity. But on December 29th, Paris happened on this blog it was a blog post that had been written back in November from Sue. And what she saw what she had written as a suicide note, and that is why she had called for the second welfare check, which she didn't realize was a second call. She was just trying to, she says in her words, just trying to keep eyes on her friend, and that she had made some suicide calls for friends before. She didn't want to mess around with it because it's like she'd rather be wrong that if her friend, then, you know, her friend will be mad at her. But I think law enforcement, for the most part, is pretty happy to knock on a door and have somebody not be dead. There was one online user, he wanted to remain anonymous, that said that Shane had been telling friends online that his parents were on vacation. And he was still posting on that Overwatch site as late as November. And then on December 23rd, he had spent quite a number of hours on Steam. There are all these reports that talk about Shane having schizophrenia and that his parents had been trying to help him for years, but there's really absolutely nothing to back that up at all. And it all seems actually to be AI-generated fluff of something. It's very strange. It's kind of like there was no real information, so it just kind of started to get made up, like made up information. And I really hate that. And I'm sure that the Vossler family hates that too. But whatever the truth was, on July 24th, 2024, something happened, like something snapped. Now, whether it was a long simmering rage, a psychotic break, or like just cold calculation, Shane killed his parents, William and Eileen Vossler, in the home that they had shared together for decades. He didn't flee. He didn't confess. He simply continued to live in the house as if nothing had happened. And Sue was there too. And whether she knew immediately or learned later, she also stayed there together in this home that had now kind of become a mausoleum. And outside of the house, the world just kind of kept going on. So it was the end of a story that had really kind of been unfolding in silence for months. And a neighbor had said once, quote, "We noticed when we would drive by that there was always a lot of activity in the driveway, working on cars and in the yard. We both noticed that suddenly it seemed like all activity had stopped. It just didn't seem right," end quote. And yet most people in the neighborhood just assumed that the family was on vacation or just preferring to keep to themselves. Others had noticed some odd things, like the blinds were always closed, there was absolutely no movement, but they hadn't thought to report it because, you know, in a quiet neighborhood, silence doesn't always raise alarm bells. So Shane's suicide kind of closed the door on the prosecution. Sue's death raised, I think, a lot of questions, like, was she a witness, a victim, was it something else? Toxicology reports were kind of inconclusive. Her online posts that she did kind of hint at despair and maybe suicide, but not complicity. But this wasn't just a crime. Like, this was a collapse, a slow unraveling that just nobody saw until it was too late. Because in the end, the most haunting part of this story isn't actually how the story ended, but it's how long it went unnoticed. And that was the annihilation of the Vossler family and the mysterious death of Sue Bin Lee. Thoughts, opinions, comments, leave them below, because I am very interested to hear what you think of this story. Like, do you think that Sue was involved in the murders, that she didn't know? Was she a victim? Was she a perpetrator? If she committed suicide, I guess that makes her a victim as well. I'm just really interested in what you think happened in this case. I hate cases like this where there's just no information. I mean, I know you can never really know what people are thinking and what's really going on. But when there's more reporting and when things go to court and there's court documents, there's just a little bit more insight that you can gain on this. This is almost impossible to know what was going on in that house. And it's an interesting story. Anyways, with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another terrible, awful, hard to comprehend story. In the meantime, you know what you can do. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Welcome to Primetime Crime Podcast. I am your host, Kylie, and in this podcast, we are going to deep dive into some lesser-known unsolved true crime cases, from missing persons to unsolved homicides. This is the place where we are going to unpack it all, research it all, talk about it all, and try to bring justice to these families after all of these years. We are going to take it one story at a time, one case at a time, and hopefully justice will be ours. I hope you all will join me on this journey. You can find me at Primetime Crime, wherever you get your podcasts.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.